Good morning, everyone. Welcome here. This is a lot of people here this morning, and I'm glad to see you all here. Lauren Jones is here this morning, and I didn't know he was going to be here, but welcome. I was quite surprised. Looks like Vernon's family is here too, and that's good as well. And welcome you all. James read a verse this morning. He read a verse in 1 Corinthians 4. Well, my marker went in the wrong place. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 8, I believe it was. Well, I can't find it here, but the thought that I was blessed with was that as I speak, I want to speak with the oracles of God. Speak whatever God wants to speak through me this morning. And as ministry, a minister where I serve by the grace of God. It's not me this morning. And I just ask your prayer that His Spirit would move this morning. Who said, "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect"? Who said that? Jesus said that. And this morning, I'd like to think about that a little bit in that context that he shared. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which in heaven is perfect, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. If we're the children of our Father, that means we're like him. The tree bears other trees of the like fruit or like trees. For he maketh his sun, our Father, maketh his sun to rise on the evil as well as the good, and sendeth rain on the just as well as the bad or the unjust. You know, God, in his perfection, he treats each the same. He sends the rain on the good, sends the rain on the bad. He makes the sun come up on the bad, and the same sun shines on the good. And that's how we're supposed to act. We're supposed to be perfect like that. And what is he talking about? If you would, turn to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, verse 38. Jesus gave us some simple, practical, but exceedingly difficult instructions here. And it's instructions in dealing sometimes with what we call life's unfair challenges. I don't know if you've ever found yourself in unfair situations where you think it's unfair. And as Mennonites, we've grown up from little up with the teaching of non-resistance ingrained in us. And we have a head knowledge of what that is. It's been something that is just part of our standard. So we believe that. And we promise that's what we believe. And some of us have the practical experience from the school of life. Some of you here have had that probably to a greater degree than what I've had. But we all say we agree that, or we have said that at some point in our life. And some of us have failed in this area, in the school of life. So let's see what Jesus has to say and remind us of on that today. So Matthew 5:38 says, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain, or whosoever shall compel thee to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? Doesn't just the everyday people around us do the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. In other words, he's saying God makes his son come up on the evil and on the good. He treats him the same. And in your life, our life, we're supposed to treat people the same as well. For you children, do you remember the children's class from 2 Sundays ago about Peter? Do you remember that? I don't see anyone. So what did Peter do? Just say if you know, because I can't see your hands very well. Alex. He offered them food, yes. What did Peter not do? Other Alex back there. Now, he didn't hurt him, right? That's right. So this thing of non-resistance here, I'd like to break it into two parts this morning. I think it's broken into two parts here. One is it's not retaliating, non-resistance. It's just taking it and not doing something in return. That's the first part. The second part, which is the part that really gives life to this, is love. Think about that. We have a movement in the world called, and this is, it's, there's so many different facets to this, it's kind of hard to pin it all down. But a lot of times when we say we're Mennonites, people say, oh, you're pacifists, right? Well, there's a difference between pacifism and non-resistance as Jesus taught it. The perfect kind of non-resistance, I'm going to call it. One is just an absence of retaliation, or an absence of war, an absence of violence, an absence of harm. Do no harm. That's a creed that the from some other religions take that creed, do no harm. And it's a good creed, do no harm. I mean, do violence to no man was something that John the Baptist told the soldiers when they said, what shall we do? Do no harm. That's good. But it's a little bit like a body. We could say that non-resistance, not retaliating, is kind of like a body. But the spirit that gives life is the love that Jesus said. Love your enemies. That's kind of like this. That's the spirit that gives life. And putting those two together is the living part of non-resistance. Okay, so let's go. Ye have heard, in verse 38, ye have heard. What did they hear? This Jesus was preaching from an Old Testament perspective here. And his followers, his people, that he was, or his audience, knew what they've heard. So what did they hear? Let's look at Leviticus 24:19. You can turn there. There's two verses. Leviticus 24:19. There's more that cross-reference to this, but they all kind of say the same thing. So I picked out these two. Leviticus 24:19. This is what they have heard. It says, "And if a man cause a blemish in his neighbor, as he hath done, so shall it be done to him. Breach for breach, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he hath caused a blemish in a man, so shall it be done to him." So, I'm driving my truck down the road, and I cross the center line, and I do a head-on collision with a man in a motorcycle. Now, the man on the motorcycle is wearing a helmet, and he flies 100 yards and lands in a cornfield, but he breaks his arm, he breaks 5 ribs, and his 2 legs. So this man is in bad shape, but he's not dead. I've caused a blemish in him. The motorcycle man is now, he's not the same as he was before I hit him. So I have caused this man harm. So he would have the right to, when he gets better, or his family, to do the same thing to me. Maybe not hit me on a motorcycle, but they could break 5 ribs, 2 legs, 1 arm. As I did to him, so I receive. Or, that's kind of an unintentional one. But let's say that I was angry with someone, and I took my hammer, and I hit him. And I knocked out 3 front teeth. And I was still angry with him, and I kept beating him, and I damaged his right eye. So, but then I felt really bad, so I come and I say, I'm sorry. What do they do? So, they could do the same to me. They could damage my right eye. If I damage his right eye, they could damage my right eye. And they could knock out 3 front teeth. Now, there was cities of refuge in the Old Testament. That if the first scenario was an unintentional one, the second scenario is an intentional one. So in the first case, I could run as fast as I could go. And if I get to the city of refuge, then I could they would have a court hearing, and they would say, well, what happened? Well, it was unintentional, so you are here. If you leave the city, they can do the same to you. They can break your legs. They can deform you the same way you deformed him. But as long as you're here, it's unintentional. That was an unintentional accident, so you're safe here. But the second one, I wouldn't be safe because it was an intentional one. And so the family would have just cause. Most likely, if it was, depending on all the circumstances, but the city of refuge wasn't an automatic thing. If it was actual crime committed or something like that, then I would not be safe. I would be eye for eye, tooth for tooth, whatever. That's what they have heard. Ye have heard an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And justice, that's what it is, justice. According to the law, we'll do justice. But Jesus says, I say that ye resist not evil. So, whosoever will smite you on your right cheek. If somebody hits you on your right cheek, then your job is not to go and hit him on his right cheek. Your job is to turn and let him hit you on the left cheek. No, they said. That's what Jesus said. If any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have your shirt too. And that's a figure of speech, even today. We say, I lost my shirt on the deal. If I lose it, if they take your coat, give him your shirt. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him too. I'm not sure what all the connotation was there, but it involves an interruption of schedule anyway, either way. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. So when we think of non-resistance, not retaliating, what comes to our mind right off? What comes to your mind when you think of non-resistance? Just first thing that pops in.
Not fighting.
No fighting. Okay. Not going to war. We could say that. That's one of the first things. Or not fighting back. No, not filing lawsuits and all that. That's some of the first things that pop into our mind. And non-resistance includes, there's four things here in Jesus' resist not evil sermon. And the first one, I will say, personal bodily injury. Smite the cheek. That would be bodily injury, right? Intentional bodily injury. That would be the kind that you would be fully justified in swinging back and hitting them on the right cheek again if they hit you on the right cheek. But Jesus says, no, you don't do it that way. You turn the left cheek and you let them hit that one. And then maybe they'll feel better. But you'll be the one that takes the brunt. So, personal bodily injury, what's our response to intentional harm that comes our way? Or even the threat of intentional harm, what's my response to that? You know, I've never been physically hit by an enemy in really hard. The only time that I would have come closest to it was in Oregon. I was holding a street sign by the road, by a street, and it was a weird situation. It was at a rock concert, and there was a people that were in all sorts of intoxication and other situations. And anyway, I got swatted for holding a street sign, but it wasn't real hard, and it didn't. It was okay. I didn't suffer over it. But I've never been physically harmed by somebody with an intent, intentional physical harm. Brothers don't count, but by somebody that was otherwise. It's a good exercise for us to mentally determine Christ-like ways to respond in extreme situations. I'm going to call a personal bodily injury extreme situation. We all know the hypothesis of what would I do if somebody came into my house and tied me up and so and so and so. What would I do? What would you do? We know those. And we think of those. But those I'm going to call extreme situations. It's probably not going to happen unless lawlessness would descend or some major calamity or something. Probably not, but it could. It could happen. But that would be an extreme situation. So it's good for us to determine in our minds what we would do in a situation of extreme scenario like that. Our response in extreme situations will most likely be in accordance with our responses and our life in minor situations. So what are some minor situations that we're more likely to face? Well, Jesus got practical with that too. He said, if any man will sue you at the law. So there we have legal injury or reputation damage, we could say. There's all kinds of ways that people bring lawsuits over. Some of the more common ones are for damages. Accidents, for one, is a common legal thing. Or maybe unpaid bills is another one that's pretty common. Or damages, perceived damage. Even people saying bad things about other people, they can sue them for damage to their reputation. Or at least try to. So, some of us here have probably been involved in lawsuits already. Hopefully not on the plaintiff's side, but on the defendant's side. We have been involved in lawsuits. Some of us have been threatened with lawsuits. So how do we respond? How do we respond if we are get that letter or that notification, if the sheriff brings that to you? How do you respond? Is my first response to find the best lawyer I can to defend my position and protect my assets and all that? Well, I mean, it's probably good to find a lawyer. Otherwise, you're automatically guilty. But there's ways to go about it that help navigate this, maybe. Now, what's my attitude toward those publicans or those sinners or those, we wouldn't call them publicans and sinners, but the people that did that. What's my attitude towards them to take my hard-earned property and money and assets that I've worked so hard for and that I've firmly attached to? If any man will sue thee at the law and take away that coat, let him have that cloak too. Am I known as someone who knows how to passively pressure people to accomplish my ends? Gary Miller wrote a book, and he had a character in there called Slick Simon, I think it was. And Slick Simon was somebody that knew how to do that. It was kind of a fictional character, but it was... there's probably a few people that we could know of or have known in the past, maybe, that would be similar. And am I one of them? That's probably something to think about. Okay, a third one. If any man compel thee to go a mile, go with him too. So we don't have soldiers that can compel us to carry their pack a mile. I don't know if that was even a thing back then or not. I've heard it was, but I don't know. It might have been and it might not. I don't know. But if any man compel thee to go a mile, go with him too. The only thing I found about compelling someone to go was when they were carrying Jesus' cross, they compelled Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross for this man, for Jesus. So they compelled him to do that. Or they forced him to. But we don't have that today. But we do have people that come and maybe there's unexpected demands on our time, in our schedule. We have a tight schedule, and then we have somebody that says, "Hey, I've got cars broke down an hour away, and could you come and help me, please? I really, really need you to come." And this person might not even be your best friend. He might be somebody, or she, or whatever, might be somebody that you really rather not see today. And so that's, and yet you feel like God is telling you, you need to go, drop what you're doing, go do it. But how do I respond to those unexpected demands on my time? It's a schedule change. Or maybe it's an unfair type of demanding schedule change. Maybe it's not really your fault. Maybe it's somebody else's fault, but it's still, circumstances still make it so that you have to go. Unexpected schedule change. Even this can be frustrating, but if you're really busy in the springtime, especially, and you have government mandated demands like tax preparation and paperwork and forms and other government type of things, and you say, why do they need so much paperwork? Things are getting out of hand these days, and that's a schedule change. So do I grudgingly condescend to help, or do I make them feel as small as I possibly can? That's the passive form of retaliation, maybe. Or am I Christ-like? Do I willingly help? Something to think about. The fourth one here is people taking advantage of my things. We all had people, well, most of us probably have borrowed things from people, and we've had people borrow things from us. And what's my, how do I feel about that? And there's ways borrowing. We talked to some in Sunday school this morning about the poor people. There's poor will always be with us. Jesus said the poor you'll always have with you. And in Deuteronomy it talks about the poor will always be around. You'll always have poor in the land, whether it's their fault or somebody else's fault or whatever, more poor management or genetics or whatever. They're going to always have poor people. And you'll have people that are down and they're going to be, well, no, genetics doesn't have anything to do with it, but you'll have people that have that are always needing something. And if I have the wherewithal to help somebody and they ask me, what do I do? Material aid, use of my things, or financial assistance, food maybe, whatever. What do I do? What do I do? Think about that, how you would respond in that situation. You know, the thought in Sunday school this morning was that, and I think Tony had read this in Adam Clark's commentary about the poor having, owning whatever. I don't know if they actually own it. I don't know how to feel about all that, but God does have, his will is that we share, especially in our in church, that excess supplies lack. It's that there may be equality. Paul talks about that. Excess, it's supposed to flow around, that needs are met, and that there's not huge disparity among people, that there's not needs that are going unmet. Okay, so that was the retaliation part. Do not retaliate. We have bodily injury. We have demands on time, legal injury, reputation damage, and we have people taking advantage of things. Those are things that we can do, and we can actually do those. And just the mere act of doing that fulfills the non-resistance part, right? So we're good, non-resistant people if we do what it says here. We don't sue. We had a lawsuit. We paid the bill and said a few bad things about them behind their back. But we paid the bill and we didn't sue them back. And we, whatever, we loaned our stuff out and all that. But we can do all that stuff. We can do all those things and fulfill that part. It's like the body, but if there's no spirit, if there's no love there, what does it do? It just fulfilled that particular spot, but it wasn't really the perfection, the perfect part that God was talking about. So non-resistance, by definition, is not retaliating, or we could say non-resistance could say doing no harm. But is it enough to practice non-resistance alone? Would that make us perfect like our Father? We talked about pacifists. Pacifists believe war is wrong. And pacifists hold rallies to pressure the government to say that war is wrong. We should not send the military to Iraq to bomb the poor people over there and destroy the buildings and the oil refineries and all that. We should not do that. It's wrong. It's wasteful. It's destructive to the environment and all kinds of things. It's wrong. So we should, many, and some of them, pacifists, they take it, it's a moral, there's a moral reason for not killing and fighting. And that's a good thing. But a pacifist can be a pacifist without being converted, without being a Christian. You can be a pacifist without being a Christian. And by doing just the first part there of not retaliating, without exercising love, basically we are a pacifist. We can do that most of the time without being a Christian. We can subscribe to the idea of doing no harm and still allow angry thoughts and feelings and the attitudes to be in our heart, but not do it. And that could be expressed like the Quaker who was very angry with another man, but he had a religious constraint. He could not fight because he couldn't. He just couldn't. But he was very angry, and so he thought of a neat workaround. He said to his neighbor, he says, "Friend, I do thee no harm, but where thou standest, I am about to shoot." So if he died, it wasn't his fault because the man was in the way. Well, that's not a... If he had love in his heart, that wouldn't happen that way. He couldn't do that. So what really differentiates true non-resistance from pacifism is love. So let's read Matthew 5:43. "Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy." Ye have heard. Here's that word again. What did they hear? Ye have heard. I think this was the revolutionary part. That and, well, both of it was revolutionary to Jesus' audience. So what did they hear? Leviticus 19:17-18 was what they had heard before. It says, "Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thine heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord." Do a study sometime for the I ams of Christ, or I ams of God. It is very interesting. I am the Lord. You do this because I said so. I am the Lord. "And the Lord said unto Moses," this is Exodus 17:14-16. It's another thing they have heard. "Write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." This is the hate part. Hate thine enemy. The first was love thine neighbor. This is hate thine enemy. "I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." Deuteronomy 23:3-6. "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to their tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. Thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all thy days forever." Psalm 41:10. "But thou, O Lord, be merciful unto me, and raise me up, that I may requite them," the enemies of God. Psalm 139:21-22. "Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee, and am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies." So you have heard. Love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I say, Matthew 5:44 again, "Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun." God does this. God makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. "For if you love them which love you," if you just love your church people, what reward do you have? I mean, the worldly people do that. "And if you salute only your church brethren," you just are all friendly with them, What do you do more than others? The world does that. And then he finishes that, be therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Love your neighbor and hate your enemy was what you have heard. But you know, sometimes do we reverse that? Just because we have been taught, you know, love your enemies, love your enemies, love your enemies. We've been taught that. But do we reverse that and love our enemies and hate our neighbors? Do we ever have that problem? Sometimes we wonder, is there room for hate, or we could say lovelessness, because hate is a pretty strong word, if we just don't like somebody. Is there room for that in a Christ-like person? Non-resistance coupled with love is the very essence of Christ. In 1 Peter 2, 19, it says, for this is thankworthy. This is explaining it a different way, maybe, comparing it with Christ, how we can suffer things. If a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongfully, that's thankworthy toward God. For what glory is it if when you be buffeted or persecuted or harassed for your faults, ye shall take it patiently? What glory is that? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example, that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. He was perfect. Who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Love's not something that we can manufacture in our own strength. We first need to be born and baptized of the Holy Spirit. In other words, we need to be converted. We need to be born again to have the love and non-resistance together. It takes a continual brokenness of self as well, because without that, we keep it, that can hinder our non-resistance also. The practical workings of non-resistance begin with love and they end with love. To be faithful in the extreme circumstances, it requires faithfulness in the minor circumstances. It's a mindset. In other words, to be faithful in the extreme, robber coming in the door, tying you up, to be faithful there, it takes a mindset all through life. And I'd like to just close here with 1 Corinthians 13. I don't know if I'll read the whole thing or not. But love is the end of all things, basically. It's the Spirit that gives life to non-resistance. It's the Spirit that gives life to what we do for Christ. We can do a lot of this, a lot of these things without love, and it is, well, I'll just let 1 Corinthians 13 tell you what it is. Verse 1, it says, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity or love, I am become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. So somebody that speaks well without love is just rattles. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, I am a spiritual person and I've got it together. I have no charity, I have no love, I am nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and I have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. You could also say, even though I endure all the lawsuits in the world, and even though I have let people hit me on the cheek, on both cheeks, multiple times, and I still am angry with them inside, it doesn't do me any good. Or even if I loaned all my things out and let people tear it up, and I had to start all over, I went bankrupt because of it, but I still hated him. Didn't do me any good. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. You know, love is humble. Love is not about me. Love is about you or other people. It does not behave itself unseemly. It's not unruly. It's not self-serving. It seeketh not her own. It's not easily provoked. It thinketh no evil. You know, love gives the benefit of the doubt. How does that apply in non-resistance? It rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. Love beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. Whether you have the best gifts in the world, whether you are the smartest person in the world, whether you can talk the best, all that's going to go away, but love keeps going. For we know in part, we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. I could also say, before I was converted, I did all those things. After I was converted, I put away those things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. I'd just like to leave that thought that non-resistance starts with love. It ends with love. And if we practice it according to God's word, then we can be perfect like our Father. Let's stand for prayer.